Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, baby. Hello, rebel baby. Hello, baby. Today.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of the Brown Baby Podcast. I am your host, Nikesh Shukla. I am an author, a screenwriter, and I am also very easily impressed. This weekend, I discovered a cocktail that comes with a scoop of lemon sorbet in the middle, and quite frankly, it's all I can think about. As we record this, I'm imagining the sweet and sour fuzzy cloud that the melting sorbet is forming with the delicious Prosecco. Anyway, this is a podcast about parenting. It asks the question, how do we raise our kids to be joyful in bleak times that make us so sad and angry? Each week, I invite a parent on to chat to me about their parenting journeys, how they're navigating these tricky times with their kids, how to have important conversations, and how to still have fun and enjoy the world. This is a hopeful podcast about parenting, and it's inspired by my memoir, Brown Baby, a memoir of race, family, and home, which has been out since September. I hope you have your copy. Okay, so this week's guest is the journalist and writer Safraz Manzoor. Safraz is the author of the recently released book, They, What Muslims and Non-Muslims Get Wrong About Each Other, where he goes on a journey around Britain in search of the roots of this division, from the fear that Islam promotes violence to the suspicion that Muslims wish to live segregated lives to the belief that Islam is fundamentally misogynistic. Safraz is an amazing writer who wants to basically challenge these assumptions about Islam. They is also his search for a more positive future. We hear stories from Islamic history of a faith more tolerant and progressive than commonly assumed, and stories of hope from across the country, which might show how we can bridge the chasm of mutual mistrust. It's a remarkably hopeful book. Now, this Bruce Springsteen obsessed journalist is also the author of Greetings from Bury Park, his memoir about growing up in Luton and being obsessed with The Boss. He worked on the adaptation, which was called Blinded by the Light, which has just hit streamers. If you want let's not go there. Hey, look, he was one of the first people to ever write about my work, and I respect him greatly. Even if during this conversation he questions the mantle he wears, I respect his work and what he has carved out and the space that he has made. We speak about our kids, about technology, about what musical instruments they shouldn't learn, how to have difficult conversations, whether the world is as bleak as I describe or a more hopeful place as he describes, and how anguished I am. It's an illuminating chat, and one that has definitely made me see the world in a new light. I really enjoyed my time with Safraz. So please, welcome to the podcast, Safraz Manzoor. So welcome to the podcast, Safraz Manzoor. How are you doing today? You've just come back from Latitude Festival. You look definitely like you are sick of tents. I don't know, I can't tell. How are you today?
Can I tell you something really funny, actually? So I'm not really a camping person myself, as in I've become into
two brown men who are not into camping. Tell me more.
You know what I mean? But my wife is hugely into that, and this is one of the many, many compromises that I've made. But I went to Latitude on my own.
How did you?
Which was kind of like, you know, it was kind of amazing, to be perfectly honest, because I didn't have to like take the kids to the kids area the whole time. I could just enjoy myself. But it meant that I had to take a tent and learn how to put the tent up, which I have not got a clue on. So I spent quite a lot of time with my wife kind of showing me the way to do it in the garden. And I was like, I did it. I sort of did it, but I did it wrong. Then I did it again. She's like, all right, you're fine. You'll do it. And I was like, no, you know, like how that I think is in Full Metal Jacket when that guy can, where they can put a gun together, but blindfold. And yeah, I was like, I want to be like that with the tent. I want to just be able to do it. So I got almost to it. Then I got on Friday night, I get there and I'm on site and I lay out the first part of the sheet. And I'm like, okay, right. So two poles, one cross, one cross. And these two guys come up to me and they say, are you Safra's Manzo? I was like, yeah. And he goes, I got to say, I absolutely loved Blinded by the Light. Mate, that was a great film. And I was like, look, I'm really happy to talk to you, but is there a chance you could put the tent up while we're chatting? And they did. So I
kind my God.
I thought I'd regale them with some anecdotes of the film shoot, and they basically put the tent up.
Oh my God, this is a genius move. You're like, oh yeah, I did meet Springsteen and this is the conversation we had. And oh, could you just angle that a bit more? I don't think that's taught enough, actually.
Exactly. And I was just, no, I think you meant to do some tying up of the two, the inner and the outer. Isn't there some sort of tying up thing? So anyway, so I get there and I'm backstage. It's like, it was like that. So that was very, very funny. But no, it was fantastic. And I was just like, it felt, you know, 15 months of really not, more, I thought my wife on my birthday got me one of the things she got me was a disco glitter ball, and it's in the living room. And the idea is, look, we can't dance, we can't go out anymore, but we can, you know, we can have a little dance in the living room. And you realise it's really not the same as being in a room, or being in the living room is not the same as being with 40,000 people. And just having that kind of collective shared experience was kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because last week, it's not the same thing, but bear with me, I went to see the Fast and Furious 9. I really wanted to go and see a big blockbuster, dumb action film that makes no sense, but kind of is aware of how stupid it is on a big screen in a dark room with more popcorn than I can handle. And I just spent the whole time like in the experience of going to the cinema rather than watching the film. And it made me realise that, man, I've really ruined film by just watching it on my laptop for the last year.
Yeah.
I've really missed the kind of the communal experience. The irony being, me and my mate were the only ones in the cinema.
Oh, God.
But there was just something about the experience that made me think.
There is something about, I think it's about exhilaration, isn't it? I think that's what that's what I've kind of missed. Euphoria and exhilaration and those sorts of things.
There's also like a romantic routine around it as well, I think. Going to a gig or going to a festival or going to the cinema or going to the theatre. Like, you prepare yourself in lots of interesting ways, right?
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, and because like I don't drink, so I spend a lot more time thinking when I'm around there in a kind of, you know, what does it all mean kind of way than maybe some people do. But when you go to something like Latitude, yes, it's self-selecting, yes, it's middle class, blah, blah, but it also, you sort of see a version of the country that feels quite positive.
Yeah.
You know, you see people in their 70s who are looking ridiculous and they don't mind. You see teenagers. It was really funny. I was right at the front at the Chemical Brothers and there were these young girls and we're just like chatting. And I was like, you look really young to be Chemical Brothers fans. And they were like, we're just holding the spots for our dads. They're going to join us in 10 minutes. And I thought that's so cool that these guys are bringing their teenage kids and they're all enjoying something. So you kind of emerge more positive about Britain, to be honest, saying, yeah, this is also Britain.
These are the people for whom the Euro final never actually happened, hasn't happened yet.
Yeah,
they're still feeling hopeful about the country.
Yeah, you know, it's about tribes, isn't it? You sort of feel like, well, this is my tribe in a way as well. And I think when you're on your own for a long time or you have that kind of atomized life that we've all had, you can sort of slightly lose your tribe.
Yeah, I just also really like the mental image of Safra's Manzo front row of the Chemical Brothers pogoing to Hey Boy, Hey Girl and thinking, what does this all mean?
surrounded by 40,000 people. There was a little bit of that, but luckily I didn't write an 800 word think piece up whilst I was there. I was mostly pogoing, but you know what I mean? It's just like, it's the nearest, because I don't do any kind of, you know, I don't go out, I don't get out of my head on any kind of substances, and I've never drunk or anything like that. So this is the nearest I get to losing it, you know, to losing to being, and that's kind of a nice feeling to have.
Yeah. So tell me, we'll get on to talking about dad life in a bit, but I just want to bring readers up to date with what's been going on for you. So obviously, 2 or 3 years ago, Blinded by the Light came out, the film adaptation of your.
No, No, 2 years ago, 2019.
The adaptation of your memoir Greetings from Bury Park, and that was a lovely, really warm film with a great lead. I can't remember his name, but that young man,
yeah,
he was great. And his best mate, the Sikh guy, was really, really funny. And you've got your book, They, which has just come out. Tell me about how the last few years have gone for you, because obviously it's been a while since Greetings from Bury Park came out, and obviously, like, getting that film done and out was felt like quite a long time in the making. And then obviously you've been working on this steadily for like a chunk of the previous years.
Well I mean, to be honest, basically, you know, the first book came out in 2007, and this book's coming out 14 years later or something, which is kind of nuts. But what happened in that time was that I got married and I had two kids, and you know, when I After that happened, really, my productivity just absolutely plunged. And when it came to kind of doing anything big, I was always just like, well, I can't think of an idea that's so important that I can find the time in all my other commitments of, you know, parenthood and journalism, etc., to squeeze this other thing. And the film, the reason it takes, I mean, you'll know this as well, these things take a long, long time. The funny thing about a film is that it takes a long, long time, and then it happens ridiculously fast. So we started it in sort of 2010 or something. And then when we got the money, it was being filmed within 4 months. So it actually goes slow and then really, really fast. But what the film did was, I guess it gave me two things, really. It kind of gave me the chance to have a little bit of freedom to be able to focus on the things that I really wanted to do, you know. So since the film, I've just like, I do journalism, but I only do it because I genuinely like doing stuff. So if somebody says, you've got a chance to meet X, I'll do it. But I really just thought, you know what, I'm only going to focus on bigger projects that take longer to do. And I've now got a little bit more of that kind of financial freedom to be able to just focus on bigger things and not worry about, you know, the weekly. So that's the one thing it did. And then the other thing it did was, you know, it's a really specific story about Luton and the 80s, and yet it found like this international audience. And so, you know, obviously it went to America and Japan and all this. And so I get these messages on Instagram and Twitter from Chile or Mexico or New Zealand or whatever, people connecting. And you realize the power of storytelling to try and tell very culturally specific stories can actually reach people and make a little bit of difference whilst they're being entertained. And actually, that was quite interesting, because when I started writing They, I started thinking, right, I want to use what I've learned about storytelling, about screenwriting, about how you can actually reach people to tell fairly uncomfortable things, but through storytelling rather than polemics and what have you. So that sort of actually helped feed into the writing of They.
And So the line that I just wanted to draw between those two works, between They and Blinded by the Light, more than Greetings from Bury Park, because Blinded by the Light, I think, is much more nostalgic about Luton in the 80s than perhaps the book is. And obviously writing They, you reckon with what Luton has become and what it's become like symbolic of in the conversation around far right extremism and Islam and British Muslims. And so how did you kind of square those two things when you were kind of working on them?
I mean, it might be helpful to sort of just like talk a little bit more broadly about why I wrote the book, because in a way Luton's not, it's in it, but it's not really in the new book. It's in it occasionally, you know.
Yeah.
So the trigger for the book really was, like I said before, I didn't have a book to write, didn't have any reason to. Didn't notice anyone clamoring for a second book from me. So that there was nothing, it was all pretty quiet. And then basically, you know, 2016 happened, and you had Manchester Arena attack. And I went to uni in Manchester. You had London Bridge, you had Westminster Bridge, you had Donald Trump, you had Brexit, you had Joe Cox being murdered. You had the lingering story of Rochdale and Rotherham and all the kind of child sexual exploitation stuff goes on. And then the following year, in 2017, a guy only minutes from where I live tried to drive a van into Finsbury Park Mosque. And all of that stuff just really, really got me down, because it just made me feel hopeless, to be honest, because I just started thinking, is this the Britain now? Is this the country that I have as my home, you know? And didn't feel like there was anywhere else I could go to. I had too many roots in this country and I've given a lot to it and it's given me a lot. But I just felt scared of the country it was becoming. And maybe scared is the wrong word, but I felt deeply apprehensive. And I just started thinking, okay, well, is there anything within my modest skill set that I can do to make a difference? Do you know, like literally, what can I do? And I thought, well, what about trying to do something for my kids? Because my daughter now is just about to turn 10. My little boy's 4 3/4. And they aren't absolutely fully yet aware of the toxicity around Islam and all that. But they're totally aware of skin colour and they're totally aware of that stuff. And I had to walk my daughter a different route so she didn't see all the stuff of the police vans and everything around the Finsbury Park attack. And I was just like, I would really hate it if they grew up feeling really happy and comfortable with my wife's white Scottish heritage, but they felt like mine, my Pakistani Muslim background, was problematic. That would really, really sadden me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write a book for them and I'm going to actively find the reasons to feel hopeful. And so I went out and thought, okay, well, if I was to meet an Islamophobe right now and I was to ask him or her, what do you think about Islam and what do you think Muslims are like? What would be the 9 or 10 things that this person would say? Like, what would a bigot say about Islam? And I thought they'd say, oh, they all want to live amongst themselves. They all marry each other. Their religion is violent. They look down on white people. They hate this country. They've got different values. And I literally just wrote them all down. And I thought, okay, I'm going to tackle every single one of these things. But rather than doing it in a kind of polemic where I just like wang on and I just talk as if declaiming these big statements, I'm going to go out and tell human stories about real people whose lives intersect with some of this stuff. And then Luton becomes part of that because, for example, the EDL come from Luton and the march where the British soldiers return to Luton, that's what spawns the EDL, for example. So Luton becomes a character in it, but I travel around the whole country just meeting in loads and loads of people. And the idea was to try and tell a story. And I guess the question I was asking myself is it naive to feel hopeful? Do you know what I mean? Like, do you have to be totally rose-tinted and naive to feel hopeful? Or can you be both clear-eyed and hopeful? And that's the kind of journey I try to set myself up on. And my story and the story of Luton becomes a splinter within that, but nowhere near as much as it was in Greetings from Bury Park and in Blinded by the Light.
One of the things I think is interesting about the two books that we've had out this year, with my memoir Brown Baby and with both of them are striving for a vision of hope. And because the central question that I'm asking at the heart of my memoir is, how do we raise our kids to be hopeful in a world that seems so fucking bleak and fucked? And I feel so sad and angry about it. Like, how do I then, who am I in that interaction with my kids? And so, like, you know, you said it was a modest skill set. I disagree, because I am one of those highfalutin writers that think that a book can change the world. But
it's not mine.
or mine. But, you know, that, like, there is that thing of, like, us reaching to future generations to kind of give them hope that I think is, you know, for me, it's directly in conversation with James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, and even Ta-Nehisi Coates's Between the World and Me, because I think that in order to feel hopeful about the future, you kind of have to present what now means and how. To kind of give you an example of this, so we live in Bristol, about 20 minutes walk away from where the Colston statue was pulled down, and my daughter goes to a school that has a very a tangential association with Colston, and so that, you know, that they involved the teachers there, involved the whole student body in a conversation around that association with Colston. And my daughter wanted to know more. She wanted to know more about British Empire. She wanted to know more about slavery. She's 6. And she asked me to tell her about the Bristol bus boycotts, because we live not far from where those bus boycotts, where the community that galvanised around those bus boycotts all lived. And in order to explain the boycotts to her, I had to explain to her what racism was, which is interesting because I've never spoken to her about what racism is. I've only ever tried to make her feel proud of her skin colour and her heritage and her background and all of those things. But I've never spoken to her about the negative side of that. And I realised that as I was trying to explain it to her, and she wasn't getting it. She just thought, I said to her in as simplistic a way as I thought, there are some people who treat other people differently and quite negatively because they are a different skin colour to them. And that's not right, is it? And she said, but that doesn't make any sense. That I don't understand that. What, like, that feels stupid to me. And I found myself in that moment going, oh, well, you know, maybe someone would be racist because... And then I stopped myself and I realised that what I was doing was I was trying to get her to see the world through my eyes. I was projecting my cynicism and my world weariness and my jadedness onto her, when actually the thing that I needed to do was explain the world to her as she understands it, which is a much more generous act, I think. And I definitely get that feel from reading They, that is how you're trying to, you know, it feels like you're trying to have a very complex conversation with future generations by, you know, not being cynical about the way things are. I think that's a really, really important thing.
Yeah, that's really
interesting.
I mean, I read your book and I knew about your book, but I didn't read it while I was writing mine because I worried that I might inadvertently bleed some insights from you and pass them off as mine or something. Do you know what I mean? And it was quite interesting because when I read it afterwards, there were things which, you know, you sort of transcribed, or you mentioned conversations that your daughter had about skin colour and brownness. And I was like, that sounds really similar to what I was having conversations with. But the interesting thing about that, though, is it makes me think is two things. One is that thing that you just mentioned about not imposing that cynicism or the ugliness of how some, you know, being cliched about it, the ugliness of how some grown-ups are onto their world, you know.
Mm.
And I definitely think that's true. And there's a scene in the book where I talk about a school exchange scheme where in Luton actually happened, where there was the Asian kids in one school and the white kids in another school, and they all met together for the first time. And I was talking to them, and they had to do this thing where they had to talk about what was different about them and what they had in common. And there's an Asian kid and a white kid, and I'm saying, what do you think you've got that's different? And they were like, we support different football teams. And I was like, yeah, is there anything else? And they were like, yeah, he's got Adidas and I've got a different kind of trainers. And I was like, are you being willfully thick? Can't you see that you're Asian and he's white? You know, it's kind of... And the point was, they didn't see that. And afterwards, that was, you know, a few years back. And I really regret that because I thought, that's me totally imposing a world onto them that they don't see. But the interesting thing is, and, you know, during that whole 2016 and 17, I went to my kids and I lost myself in their world in a medicinal way.
Hmm.
And what it made me think is that world, like when my little boy goes to kindergarten and he's playing with his mates, or with my daughter, that is as valid as any other existence in any other world.
Mm.
There isn't any necessarily, I don't believe there's necessarily a hierarchy where a particular sector of what's going on is more valid than other people's experiences. So I thought, you know what, when it became really ugly during the Trump tweets and all the EDL marches and stuff, I would just lose myself in playing with my kids, thinking, this too is also reality.
Mm. Yeah, there's a real simplicity in it as well, because I have found that being the parent who wants to be empathetic and present in the way that perhaps my own father wasn't, you know, tell me how you're feeling, you know, I find that having that conversation face to face with my children, it freaks them out a little bit to kind of have to suddenly, you know, tell me how they're feeling. So they often just say that they're feeling happy at the moment whenever I ask them. But the only way to really kind of gauge how they're feeling is to play with them, because the way they dictate the play, that there's so much, it's so close to where they emotionally are that you end up discussing your feelings or how things are going through the direction of play, which I think is really fascinating.
But the other thing I find really interesting, you know, that thing you said about talking to your daughter about racism and what have you, because I'm not entirely, I guess that conversation needs to take place and I haven't had it, but there's a bit of me that thinks that I've lived my life essentially knowing that the cards are stacked against me, but living it as if they are, is, but living it as if it isn't, you know? So basically, you know that actually it's not a level playing field, but you've just got to act in the world as if it is. Because if you internalize the unlevel playing field, that will hamper you when other people are going to hamper you anyway. So there's that. So I'm sort of a little bit unsure about how much to bring in those kind of conversations, because I'm like, you know what? That stuff's going to happen, but you should just walk through the world as if it isn't going to happen, maybe. And maybe internalizing that awareness isn't always helpful.
Can you talk a little bit about how that worked for you when you were growing up? Because I think for me, I have constantly moved through life as the underdog, but I think a lot of that is to do with how I was raised.
Right.
And I think that, you know, with, and how my mum brought me up to see the world. And so that's just kind of really...
Your parents were quite, from what I read, your parents were educated activists. And so they must have imbued you with a sense of certain things are possible.
Yeah, I think my mum had a very strong sense of injustice. And my dad had a very strong sense of... My dad was like the conservative dream, like... Don't make a fuss, work hard. That was him. Whereas my mum, you know, she grew up in Keighley at a time of like great unrest in Keighley and Bradford and Huddersfield, and so that was never too far away from how she felt about things. And I think so she had this very keen sense of injustice. But also I think that sort of the way that manifested in how she raised us was very much the feeling of being the underdog, you know, which... And I think perhaps like there is like some crossover between being the underdog and moving through life as if there isn't like these sort of structural barriers. Like they both acknowledge their existence. I guess they both have sort of different execution points.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think the underdog thing is probably factually just true for a lot of people. I mean, it certainly was. That was not how I would frame it for myself, but it definitely was. I mean, basically, you know, My dad worked in a Vauxhall car factory, grew up in a very working class family, didn't know anybody. There was no sense that, you know, the only books that I remember were Reader's Digests that I, you know, get from jumble sales and stuff. So that this world that I'm currently in just was not in any way plausible. Mm. And the other part of that, which I sort of, part of the reason why I wanted to write the first book, was I'm not actually all that special. It's like, you know, if you're touched by greatness, they can be like, you know what, it doesn't matter where you come from, the way you played that violin meant you would eventually end up in Carnegie Hall or whatever. I'm kind of okay. I'm basically B+. That's all I am. So I was always struck by, well, how did I do it? And what does that... And I think it was basically... I was in Manchester during the 90s, and it's a little bit of the Gallagher brothers attitude, actually, which I kind of... Basically, I don't think... That.
We're the best fucking band in the world. That was their attitude, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it's also not. It's like, don't think that posh people or entitled people or connected people are better than you. Actually, think you're better than them. Do you know what I mean? Because I always just think to have come from where I've come from and then get into the rooms that I'm in is a much more impressive journey than most of the people that I'm around. So,
well, I'm going to blow your mind here now, Mr. Safraz Manzoor, and say this to your face: you being in those rooms is the reason I'm in those rooms now, because your visibility in those rooms, you open doors, whether actively or passively, you open doors, but your presence, your like the visibility of your presence made people like me coming up behind you feel like those rooms were possible. And so, like, sometimes you do need people to move through life in the way you do in order for the next generation to kind of look up to you and go, ah.
And it blows my mind. You know, I talk to, I think you probably know, you know Nish Kumar, don't you? I don't know him very much at all, but I know a little bit. I interviewed him once and he was talking about how when he was growing up, and he's like early to mid 30s, he never thought the idea of doing what he does was impossible because he had the Goodness Gracious Me gang already doing it. Do you know what I mean? And I literally cannot imagine what it must be like to be a kid of colour, as the kids say, and think that it's possible to be on TV, or it's possible to write a book, or it's possible to do what, you know, what Riz Ahmed is doing, or what you're doing, or what Michelle Hussein is doing, or what all these people are doing, loads of them. It's I am so a product of my time in that way that I can't even imagine it. You know, it blows my mind that we have three, we have the Home Secretary, Health Secretary and Chancellor. And yes, I know they're not my political tribe, but the fact that they're all British Asians and nobody really talks about that is mental for somebody like myself that thought, when I was a kid, I used to sometimes imagine wanting to be a Hollywood star. And the only role I could imagine playing was like Zorro, because it would be a role that would be covered up in a mask and so nobody would know that I was Asian. So even in my fantasies of fame, I could only imagine a version of fame where you were wearing a mask so nobody could see that you were brown. So that journey that we've been on is insane, you know? So I don't hold any great sort of, you know, so in terms of the way I lived my life, I lived my life by two ideas. One is, if you're going to do something for 40 or 50 hours a week, try and do something that's not going to just be absolutely mind-numbing, because that's what my dad did, that's what everybody I grew up did. And I was like, is that really all there is to life? And the second thing was, you know, don't put yourself down, because there'll be plenty of others who are going to do that for you.
It's great advice. It's really great advice. But the thing that I think is quite interesting about all of this stuff around representational politics, as it were, is I think we sometimes, well, certainly now the conversation showed me that we spend so much time going, oh, it's nice to see someone who looks like me doing the thing that is being done, because there has been a dearth. And, you know, for some people that dearth was, that dearth made them not do it, and for other people that dearth made them go, fuck it, I'm going to do it because no one else is doing it. But now what we've ended up with, as you mentioned, is like three for me very objectionable politicians who are classic skin folk ain't always kinfolk type of people. And it's made me, and actually that conversation around them has made me think recently that maybe representation for representation's sake isn't the thing that I want anymore. And, you know, ultimately I don't know where young people land on this, because it's ultimately their decisions to make about how all this moves forward. But you kind of start to think, well, yeah, a diverse room is a progressive decision, but a diverse room doesn't necessarily guarantee a progressive room. And maybe the thing that I want is a progressive room rather than a diverse one.
Yeah, I think that's all true. I think it's, I think part of it is, if you grow up and you feel that the world is possible, then the next battles can start, can't they? So if there is an aspect where a kid growing up now, she or he or they thinks, I can do X, Y and Z, and the fact that I am of this particular background or ethnicity or colour will not stop me, that's an extraordinary achievement. But here's my thing, and this is, I think, where I'm a little bit different to a lot of the people who, you know, I kind of see there's nothing wrong with celebrating those things. Like, I feel like it's fine to talk about the journey ahead, but there's nothing wrong in saying that's bloody amazing that we've got to that point as well. Do you know what I mean? So I suppose my kind of, I think I'm slightly more chirpy and perky than you are about those sorts of things. Like, I just think that's amazing, you know. And like, I remember a couple of years ago when my daughter was five, I took her to see Matilda, the musical. And I was like, you know, and she was really into the songs and stuff. And I was feeling like quite down, because I was thinking, you know, she might one day want to do this sort of work. Let's hope not. But if she ever did want to go into that sort of, you know, but she could never aspire to play Matilda, you know. So then I opened the program, and actually one of the four girls who was playing Matilda looked exactly like my daughter. And I was like, fair play, that's cool. So, and the other thing that's quite interesting is, you know, you talk about Satya Javid and Priti Patel and Rishi Sunak. Why aren't there people on the progressive side? Like, where are they? I don't really know.
Yeah, it is interesting. It is really interesting. I don't know.
It's like, that's the thing with my book, is I'm
the,
really
the closest we have is Keith Faz.
And that's not very close at all.
No.
No, not really. Not unless you want to buy some, you know, washing machine or whatever from him or whatever. But no, I mean, and the thing is, this is the thing, you see, it's like, I don't want, like, when I wrote the book, I was thinking, I don't want this to kind of, I want any, I want people to feel challenged and uncomfortable, regardless of where they are politically. Like, this is not a kind of book only for liberals or only for conservatives. And I think too often people start books, and I find these books incredibly annoying, and they do very well, and I think there's a market for them, but I just find them annoying, where people, well, the person starts with an opinion and on page one, and then basically rams it for the next 240 pages, and you basically don't feel that they have gone on a journey, or they've ever asked themselves any hard questions. Do you know what I mean? And so,
well, yeah, this is my big, sorry to interrupt, no, but this is my most my as a creative writing teacher, my biggest bugbear is writers who write from a position of knowing rather than a position of curiosity. I'm a curious writer, and I feel like, I think a lot of writers who start their lives on social media and then move to writing, they start from a position of, I'm doing air quotes for listeners, expertise, but actually I only want to read curious writers. I want writers to not know what the fuck they're talking about, but the journey, you know, the journey is the meat of it, you know.
It is exactly that. And also the other thing is, I don't want books, I don't read them, which the two things I hate are books where it feels like the conclusion is basically you would have known the conclusion from the beginning, and it's all been reverse engineered, and there's no doubt, there's a voice of God kind of aspect to the author, where they just think that somehow everything they're saying has to be manifestly true. So my book is riven with me challenging myself and doubt,
yeah,
and I'm saying, you know what, maybe I was actually wrong about this, or I kind of want to be optimistic about this, but frankly, let's be honest, so far there hasn't been that much optimism, you know. So being honest about the fact that one is one's own character and a character in the story, and not thinking you know everything, that's one thing I find really, really annoying. And the other thing I really find annoying are people where books which sort of tell you what you should be doing. I find them quite hard work as well. You know, like manifesto kind of books. Because I personally don't necessarily know what gives that person the entitled sense that they can tell me what to think. I think my publishers wanted me to make this more of a manifesto. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to tell you stories. I'm going to tell you as much as I can. I'm going to give you my own insights. But I'm not actually telling you this is what segregation should be about or not. This, let yourself, you make your own minds up about these things. And I find that those kind of proclaiming, declarative books are, I find them quite annoying too.
Well, that's me too. And that's why I purposefully set each chapter of my book up as how to talk to you about this, and then come to a conclusion that I have no fucking idea. And that's the point. None of us do. So you're a dad of a 10-year-old and
She is going to be, she's 10 and he's going to be 5 in November.
Tell me about the 10-year-old, because as my kid becomes more interested in externalizing her world, she's experimenting when we're out of the room with what button she can press on the remote control. She tries to unlock our phones all the time. You know, she's very curious about all of these things.
She's six,
yeah. And she's reading books where, you know, kids are talking about things like Instagram, and so part of me is like, I'm nervous for the next stage. And how are you feeling about this stage?
Well, so I mean, you don't mention your names, your children's names in your book, but I do, because they're I'm hoping eventually that they get modeling contracts, and then they sort of look after me later with that money. So so Layla's going to be is 10 and Ezra's 5. And so Layla, I mean, the thing is that I can't really tell you what it's like. I mean, basically it's both a joy and a nightmare, you know. That's what it's like you know, that sometimes the joy just about, you know, makes the nightmare tolerable. That's how it is, really. What's really interesting is when you see this person and you see their sensibility, and it's, you know, you think this is actually. I tell you what's very funny. Actually, it was her birthday recently, and one of my wife's friends, took my daughter, who's 10, for afternoon tea, and she came back and she said it was like hanging out with a mate. And I thought, that's quite cool now that my daughter can actually, like, she's properly into all that. So in terms of that technology stuff, my daughter goes to a Steiner school. So, you know, that's a really quite a sort of a hippie-ish kind of vibe, where basically they strongly don't encourage screens for a long time. So she didn't watch, you know, she watched like TV like once every 3 weeks until the age of, I don't know, six or seven or something. So she didn't grow up with that all around her. She's now just obsessed with books, so she just reads a hell of a lot. The things that I am finding difficult, I'd be interested to see what you think about this, is I am finding it very hard to know how to get her to do anything. Because I grew up with a value system where basically I didn't challenge my parents at all. So there was no world view in which I wouldn't do what they told me. They never hit me, but they didn't need to. It was this implied deference. Now, my children have absolutely no deference to me. I obviously can't hit them, but I don't have anything else I can do either. And so what I'm finding now is my daughter says, well, I'm not going to do something, and you actually can't make me. And I'm realizing that this is quite a difficult position on the chessboard I've got myself into. Because it's like, what do you do if somebody says, I'm not going to get dressed and I'm not going to go to school? What moral authority do you have? And this is a challenge which, you know, my parents never had and which we are wrestling with. So those kind of things are tricky. And there's also that thing about testing boundaries, you know. Like, here's a good question. It's like, she's 10 and she wants to go out to the shops to buy something. Do you let her? I'm nervous. I'm like, we're living in London. Obviously, there are psychopaths on the street, most likely within 50 yards. Yeah, but my wife's idea is, you know, you have to trust your children and blah, 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 on all that. So those are the sorts of tension points that we're kind of facing at the moment.
Is that sort of purgatory between complete dependence and complete independence, I guess?
The only thing I can be pleased about is it hasn't got to the stage where she's going to be she hasn't yet started taking, you know, transport on her own and things. That stuff terrifies me, I have to be honest.
So to go back to the thing that you were saying before, because it's something that I wrote about in Brett Brown Baby, this idea of the infallible parent is something that obviously you and I probably grew up with, you know, the parents that you don't question, the parents who like put you to work, you know, put me to work around the house. Like, if I wasn't going to help my dad in the warehouse on weekends, I was looking after my cousins, you know. And in order to be the opposite of that, in order to be the super present father who is invested in my child's world and, you know, giving her choice and all the rest of it, that choice does mean that when you have to be the adult in the situation, it becomes harder to convince them that you are, that there is a hierarchical structure in place.
Well, I was talking to Ezra the other day and I asked him to do something and he just said, you think you're so cool, don't you? Who came up? How did you come up with that? You know, but here's the thing though. Do you think, you know, that thing about the chores and things, which, you know, I grew up doing, I think those are really good things. You know, I don't think that's a bad thing to have to know that you should be doing things. You should be expected to do things. You shouldn't have to be begged. They shouldn't have to be begged to do them. You shouldn't have to be bribed to do them. It should just be part of the understanding that there are jobs to be done. I am saying this as a theoretical concept, but I've not been able to apply this whatsoever.
Yeah, I think the tension in our house is I suggested like using pocket money as an incentive, and the dissenting opinion was, and I think it's probably the correct one, no, there are certain things that are just what you do to make the household run as part of the family.
Those there are very much two schools of opinion on that, aren't there?
Yeah. And I definitely think, you know, once my wife said it, I was like, yeah, you know, you're right about that. You know, we shouldn't, like, because like, I didn't get pocket money. So it's, even that is like a weird concept for me. Like the earliest moment I could, I got a job.
Yeah. But I also think that I have to say the other thing that's quite interesting is that for a long time, I did think that, you know, I don't want to overdo it, but, you know, like wanting to be around for my kids and because I work from home, it means I'm not like, you know, I'm around much more anyway, and et cetera, et cetera. It did mean that my productivity was slumped and I did feel like, well, maybe. But actually, in a way, they have, you know, it's I feel what I really feel good about with that is you feel like it's so nice to feel like you've got toppings on all parts, all slices of the pizza. Do you know what I mean? So I kind of like, I don't even think about writers or anyone else now who don't have kids and think of them as in my world, because it's like, I don't know what that must be like now. I genuinely have no idea what it must be like to have no kids and to be doing what, you know, because yes, it'd be amazing because you could just start in the morning with an idea and just work at it, but why? I just, there seems like a kind of a pointlessness to it. And it's like, so I went to Latitude and it was brilliant, but then it was so nice to actually come back to the world of my family as well. And so it's given me a lot, even though psychologically, obviously, it's challenging as well. So it's kind of like, you don't realise what it gives you unless you start imagining what it must be like not to have that.
Yeah, it's funny because I think those writer friends of mine who don't have kids get lost in their own sort of creative workflow, whereas I'm like, I've got 45 minutes, dude. I've got to get these fucking pages done. Otherwise, it's not happening.
You know, it's very funny, actually. I had to interview someone the other day, and she was a TV actress, and she'd done a drama, and I had to watch 2-hour drama for the interview. And the interview was meant to be for half an hour, and the PR cut it to 15 minutes as the interview started. And I was like, I'm not having this. I rang her back and just gave her like a massive bollocking. I said, if I had known this interview was going to be 15 minutes, do you think I'd have wasted 2 hours getting up at 6 o'clock to watch this drama when I've got 2 kids and I've got better things to be doing with my time? Do you know what I mean? It's like your time becomes more precious, and the idea of spending 2 hours researching something for a 15-minute interview wouldn't have happened, you know? So I think it gives you a more, you know, as you say, it becomes clarifying as to, well, things have to have a purpose or a point, and you can't just meander over every semicolon. Do you know what I mean? So even like with this book, it's, you know, I just sort of think I did the best I could. I wrote pretty much all of it during lockdown in this room while my kids were downstairs a lot of the time with my wife. And, you know, it's like you have to, in a way, you have to know that there are these, it's like these are the limits of what you can do, and you just do the best you can within those limits. And I think if you don't have those limits of time or kids or whatever, then, as you say, you may be going to lose yourself, because there's always tomorrow, or there's always another time when you could just keep working at it.
So here's a question for you, probably more of an esoteric question about fatherhood. But can you remember a moment where you thought, I get what fatherhood is? If you've had that moment yet, you may not have done.
I get what fatherhood is.
Yeah.
I've had moments of like deep joy and pride and emotional connection. But I mean, I'll tell you what I did get. I remember when I remember the week immediately after my daughter was born. I remember I got home and I just had this massive panic. And I don't know if you ever had anything like this, where I just suddenly thought, oh my God, I've walked through the first door that I cannot walk back out of. Like,
oh, wow.
You know, like, you know what? When you marry someone, if it really goes to pot, you can leave them, right? If you have a job you hate, you can leave it. Once you have a child, you can't leave that child. Even you can technically leave them, but you can't really leave them, you know? And I thought, oh my God, I am never, ever going to be able to have the world that was outside of this room again, because that world has gone forever. And I suddenly really wanted it. And I was like, oh my God, now my entire life will be defined and shaped by this little human being. And I just had this absolute terror and fear and nervousness, because it was the first time that I'd made a decision which I could not renounce.
God.
That lasted a bit. So that was one moment. But like, you know, the moments, there are other ones when you just think you're a father. I suppose it's when you feel like, well, my daughter, for my birthday card, wrote me a list of things that she remembered about me, or memories and things like that. And one of them she said is, I really loved when I was playing online chess with my friend and I played against a avatar, and it was a particularly high one, and I really wanted to beat this avatar because you hadn't beat him and I wanted to make you proud.
Oh, that's lovely.
And I was like, that's not because of me. That was a conversation she was having with herself that she wanted to do that. So those lovely moments are really nice. And the other moments I love, this is slightly lighter, is I just love when I'll be in a car and we have one of those sort of, you know, those where you can play the phone music from your phone and it streams onto the speaker, and I'll be like, so Layla, you can choose any song you want, and she'll be like, can we have Hungry Heart? And I'm like, it's amazing that out of your own free will, you are choosing Springsteen. So it's just like, so those moments, I just feel like, you know, we've got a little connection here, and that's quite cool. So, so there are moments like that. But in terms of what fatherhood is, do you ever really know? You know, I mean, that's the big thing, isn't it? That the difference between our parents and us is that you assume this absolute confidence your parents knew what they were doing, but now you realise they were all making it up as they were going along, you know? And especially for my generation of these people, I don't know if yours was like this. Did your parents meet here?
Yeah, yeah.
So my dad came, and my mum, he left my mum in Pakistan for 11 years, and then my mum came after 11 years with my brother and my sister and me. And you think, my God, this guy left his wife for 10 years from 30 to 40 and lived basically as a single guy, and then he suddenly gets presented with three kids. Of course he's not going to have a clue about what being a dad is. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. it's a heck of a journey. It's a heck of a difference in terms of the journeys, isn't it?
Yeah. And I do think that, with this sort of this generation of kids, you know, coming from having the type of parenting we both have and the similarities of those, I really like that I can have open and honest conversations with my kids where I get to admit to being vulnerable or having made a mistake or not being entirely happy with the way certain things have panned out. And that vulnerability is something I just never got with my dad. I never saw my dad as vulnerable. I never saw him as weak or sad or, he never oscillated between sadness and joy. He just was stoic working man. And I think, you know, that's had some sort of impact on how I view work and how I view my attitude towards work. But at the same time, when my mum died is when my father became allowed people to see that he was a vulnerable human being. And I wish I'd experienced that as a teenager.
I think that's all true. And I think that's important. I think there's a danger there as well, which is, I think that one also, like, you know, I guess you have to remember that they are the stars of their own movie. And let that shine. But also, I think you don't want to be too... I sometimes worry with you, and I obviously don't know you, but just in terms of your writing and what you're talking about, I sometimes wonder whether there's too much of a level of anguish and over-worrying, which can then maybe infect your parenting.
Yeah, I think that's just me.
I know, but what I'm saying is but that can have consequences, can't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, of course it can, yeah.
So I just worry, because sometimes I don't know, but I sometimes think you can overthink and over-worry and over-focus on the ugliness, whereas actually you don't want to distort too much the lens that you're looking at things through, because there's a danger that then affects, and that becomes a lens that others look through.
Yeah, which I think is why that moment where I was talking to my daughter about racism, etc., that was a really telling moment for me, because I think it's just that reminder of you dictate for a long time how they see the world, and that comes you know, for your Springsteen is my Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility, right?
Yeah, but also lightness. I guess I'm talking about lightness. So, for example, I'll give you an example of a story which could be anguished and it could not. I was on a bus with my daughter, and she was only little. She was literally only about two, maybe three. And somebody goes to her, "So where were you born?" To my daughter, some complete stranger. Obviously just, like, noticed her colour skin colour. And my daughter just looked at her and said, "In a hospital, of course." And I was like, well, that is as valid an answer. And I'm not now going to do a little symposium explaining the reason why that woman said it. I'm just going to say, what a stupid question that woman asked. Of course you were born in a hospital. I mean, it's only a little thing, but I suppose what I'm saying is I sometimes like to, sometimes my wife complains about this. I just sometimes just, it's not bad. It's not always a bad idea to sometimes undercut the ugliness of the world with some of the wit and the joy as well.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I often complain that, like, the anguish about, the first half of my career, I came into the writing world as a comedy writer. I was a sitcom writer and I wrote comedic fiction. And then The Good Immigrant happens, and then suddenly you then have another path to kind of go down.
Well,
which...
you know, you remind me of the character in Stardust Memories in Woody Allen, you know, where he says, "I preferred your earlier funny movies." You know.
So,
do you think that's valid? What I'm saying, maybe it's not. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I think you're right. Like, finding the joy is definitely something that I'm thinking
because
about.
Because one of the things you asked me to think about was, what was it like? How do you raise children?
Well, this is the question. It's the question I end all the podcasts with, which I'm just about to ask you. Like, from where you sit with your kids, what are your strategies for raising your kids to be joyful and boundless in a world that sometimes feels very heavy? That
you used the word bleak in the email you sent me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't think the world is bleak. I deny the validity of the question in that. I just genuinely don't think the world is bleak and heavy. I think there are times when it can feel overwhelming. God, of course it can. And there are times and there are people who can make you feel like that. But, you know, I start the book with a quote from Fred Rogers. You know? And I remember, basically, I think it was either the Westminster Bridge attack or the London Bridge attack, and I was feeling that the world was bleak and heavy at that time. And somebody tweeted this and said, there was a quote from Fred Rogers, the American children's presenter. He said, "When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, 'Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping.'" And that is the answer to your question, actually, that wherever there is bleakness, there will be somebody who's helping. I'm lucky I'm married to somebody who's like that, you know, and that is what I aspire to in my own life, in my own little way, you know. So for every person who says something vicious, there will be somebody else who will have done something kind. There'll be more people who have done something kind. And I think it's social media, because you spend a lot of time on Twitter and then you have to sort of eventually sort of step away again because it becomes too overwhelming or whatever. But all of that world is just, it's amplified outrage. But I don't think it's the real world. I genuinely don't think it's the real world. And so I think to just bathe yourself in the reassurance that there is also kindness and joy and beauty and good people is how you stop yourself being overwhelmed by the bleakness. And that is partly, you know, by amplifying those stories. So that's partly what I try and do in the book. Just tell the stories of people who contradict that narrative. And then the second part is be one of those people. Be one of those helpers. I'm not saying you're not, but I think that's how you do it. Because then you can say, well, you know what? We all have some capacity to move the dial. It isn't just up to the politicians. It's not just about policies. It's also people. And in every decision we make, we can move the dial towards kindness, empathy, joy, progressiveness, positivity, whatever you want to call it. And then it becomes incumbent on us to play our part in whatever way we can.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. I love that answer. It's funny because, like, you know, obviously I wrote this book last year when the world was a different place and I was a different person. And in April, I actually stepped away from social media and from a lot of other things to return to youth work, which is what I spent a lot of my 30s doing. And it gave me a lot of joy and also made me feel like I was doing something right in the world. And so, like, that idea of the helpers, I really love that quote. Thank you. Okay, so the final question before I let you get back to playing that guitar that's behind you working
is for ornamental purposes.
What is the best advice you've received as a parent, and what's the most useless advice you've ever received as a parent?
As a parent? Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was just best advice and useless advice. Okay, so the best advice, well, can I give you my, this is not what you've asked, but I'll just give you the other best advice generally as well, because it's a really good bit of advice. Somebody once said to me, and it was a quote, and they said it was from Edgar O'Brien, but it might not have been. But it was, the secret to happiness is to turn your curses into blessings. And I've always lived, I think that's a really, really lovely, so I look at that a lot. In terms of parenting, the best advice that I've had and the worst advice, okay. Well, I would say that the best advice I've had would probably be, this is quite small, but I think it's very important. Don't get your kids used to sleeping in your bed.
That's a really important one.
Because if you do that, they'll never leave.
Yeah.
So that was something which we were like, you know what? This kid's, you know, after 6 months, 8 months, you got your own place. Just, you know. So because I think that was like a, for me, I think the most important thing, and this is this is part of a bigger thing, which is don't forget that you are a married couple or a couple. And you are human beings who actually loved each other, the parents, and you are all your people who have your own thoughts and your own needs and your own time, and don't become so overwhelmed with being the perfect and present parents that you forget to give yourself time. I think that's incredibly important, you know?
Yeah, I love that.
So whether it's about having date nights, whether it's about saying, you know, it's about not... I always resisted the idea that all we are is parents after we've had kids. We're not. And I think you can lose yourself and you can lose the relationship with your significant other if you share only parenting, but you don't share in much other things. So like when me and my wife are in the house, we're often, you know, bickering and arguing about real world problems to do with kids and whatever. And then we'll go for dinner in a restaurant and she'll like dress up for it. And I'll be like, God, that's the person I dated. That's the person whose conversation is not now about what we're going to do about X and Y. It's actually just having a lovely time with somebody who I really love. But sometimes you need to allow that time separate. So that's what I'd say would be the best advice. The worst advice, I think, what? I don't know. I don't really listen to that much advice from people about those sorts of... I don't know. I suppose the worst advice I've ever been given is actually the advice from my... I think it was probably from my dad, which was this idea of do everything now, work hard, and it all, and basically live the good life in retirement.
Oh no!
And that is the culture that I grew up in, which was basically all the happiness will come afterwards, you know. And then my dad dropped dead at 62, so that was like really bad advice for me. That's something which I sort of hold on to. And in terms of childhood and parent, in terms of the best and worst advice about parent, about childhood and stuff, I don't really know. I think me and my wife argue a lot about, you know, whether we should allow children to sort of... Let me go back on this, because I'm trying to think of... I can't really think of anything really bad as advice, but I suppose the worst advice I got, actually, was from somebody who gave my daughter a saxophone and said, yeah, you should learn playing this.
Oh,
and
God.
The saxophone is right behind us in the eaves, and it is never going to be picked up. So I think choosing the right musical instrument for your daughter or your son is a really important piece of advice as well.
Something that they can plug headphones into, I think.
Exactly.
So, Frasmanzer, thank you so much.
That was great talking to you.
Thanks.
I'm glad to get a chance to finally connect with you.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Safraz for his time and to Rosie from his publisher Wildfire for making the time for this when the various COVID pings meant I had to cancel our first recording at the last minute. Thank you to my publisher Bluebird for supporting me through the podcast. Thank you to Acast as well. They, What Muslims and Non-Muslims Get Wrong About Each Other by Safraz Manzoor is out now. I have put a link to it in my affiliate shop on bookshop.org, where you can buy the book and mine. There is also a list of all of the books by previous guests. Please do help keep this podcast free. Support it through social media. Send me some change through the Acast supporter function and through buying the books. Thank you so much. See you next week, where I'll be talking to the legend that is Andy Oliver. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, my brown babies. Goodbye, my brown babies.
I love you, my brown babies, so much.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.